From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Sometimes life just isn't fair, and among its cruelest pranks is the biological malfunction that causes alcoholism. You take something that can be one of the great simple pleasures, a cold beer on a hot day, the sip of mellow single malt whiskey, the bouquet of a fine wine, and in some brains, what should be drinking pleasure becomes a raging compulsion for more, 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 with no pleasure at all.
You want to talk about this when you're forced to give up drinking, and it's something you love and you don't want to give it up. I had this bottomless need to babble about it to people.
Chicago Sun-Times writer Neil Steinberg had a lot going for him when he decided to get sober. A wife and two children he adored, and a successful career. But Corin Zailkas started drinking to excess when she was still a child.
We were always nicking liquor from our parents' liquor cabinets, whatever we could get away with. Someone always had a college-age brother. It wasn't uncommon to hike 3 miles into the woods and have a party.
Fortunately, most of us aren't alcoholics. We can enjoy adult beverages without guilt or fear. Unless, of course, we pay attention to Alice Firing and find out what else is in that glass of wine besides grapes.
There's a selection of yeast that you can be using. Then there's enzymes. There's a bunch of chemicals that you probably wouldn't like to hear about. There's a defoaming agent that's used quite a bit. That one is kind of toxic. Then there's powdered tannin, which can come from either chestnut or oak. So there is a slew of things of process and chemistry.
To alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
Alice Firing is an award-winning journalist whose beat is wine. Her blog is called In Vino Veritas, and she writes for The New York Times and Condé Nast Traveler. It's ironic that Firing is physically such a tiny person, because she has publicly taken on powerful wine critic Robert Parker, the 800-pound gorilla of the 100-point ranking system. She's written a book called The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Save the World from Parkerization. Anne Strangechamps asked Alice Firing what a glass of wine tells her when she tastes it.
It tells me a little bit about its age. It tells me, it should tell me its place. It should tell me some of the methods that we used to make it, about whether the wine was made relatively naturally or whether it was made with a lot of process. Sometimes it even tells me something about the winemaker and the way they approach a wine. It's very unlikely that a wine that seems very poetic to me is made by a control freak. So I often like meeting the winemaker and trying to, you know, kind of size up their personality next to what they actually made.
So could you explain what you mean by natural wine? Because I think an awful lot of wine drinkers think, well, wine is natural, isn't it? It's made of crushed grapes and then they've been fermented. How much more natural can you get than that?
Well, wouldn't that be nice? I was just in Bordeaux last week, and Bordeaux is not a hotbed for natural winemaking, but there are a couple, and I met with one guy. And as he's pouring me his wine, he said, you need a newspaper to list the ingredients on today's wines. And that is kind of the dirty little secret of the wine world, and pretty soon we might be seeing an ingredient label. What can you put in a wine? Well, there's a selection of yeast that you can be using, then there's enzymes, and all of these do control the flavor, the aroma, and the mouthfeel of a wine. Then there's powdered tannin, which can come from either chestnut or oak, or sometimes grape, but it's extra added stuff. There's a bunch of chemicals that you probably wouldn't like to hear about. There's a defoaming agent that's used quite a bit. That one is kind of toxic. Let's see, what else? And there's reverse osmosis, which pushes a wine through an ultra filter. So you basically have to reconstitute the wine back. So you adjust the sludge, the alcohol, and the water. So there is a slew of things of process and chemistry that you can use, and often is.
This makes it sound like the wine we pour every night was concocted in a chemistry lab.
Well, might be. It might be. I've talked to far too many winemakers who say that they never even taste the wine. They just do it by the numbers.
You're kidding.
Serious.
How can you make a wine and not taste it?
There are computers. You adjust. You pick at a certain sugar level. So you have a refractometer that will read what level that is. You don't have to taste it. It'll tell you when it's ripe. And then you're basically adjusting the pH and acidity, and you're watching all of that. Then you decide what time you're going to add the tannin, what time you're going to... It's just, you know, there are recipes.
You blame a lot of this kind of brave new world of chemically created and artificially tweaked wine on the influential wine critic Robert Parker. And he, of course, says, I just taste wine and say what I like. Who exactly is he, and why does it matter so much what Robert Parker thinks?
Robert M. Parker Jr., is the world's most famous wine critic, and nobody, it has been said by his unofficial biographer, that no one critic has ever had as much power in any field, which is dramatic because this is wine. He started in the late 70s, but really came into his sensational present position probably around 1990, when he really started having an impact on the wine world. He has a wine newsletter called The Wine Advocate that chronicles, dare I say, 1,000 wines a year. I've never counted, but certainly several hundreds of wines a year from all around the world. And he has popularized the 100-point scale. So when you go into a wine store and you see 98 points for blah, 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 that's his doing.
How much of this whole chemical world of wine can be placed at Robert Parker's door?
Well, I really wouldn't go as far as saying, well, you, Robert Parker, are, you know, culpable for this. But in seeking his approval and trying to make a wine just for that palate, people will use whatever tool they can. And he likes big wines that are very oaky, and so winemakers are going to go after that. And so because his taste has become so popular, God, you know, I can't possibly give you any sort of statistic, but it has absolutely shaped the world of wine today and the way it's made. And the fact that Parker hasn't come out and said anything against these processes and sometimes does approve of them, I don't think it's done that any good either.
So why are winemakers adding all this stuff to wine? Is it...
easier?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, is it...
It's easier.
It's
yeah.
Easier.
It's winemaking. If you're going to take... winemaking naturally is just not what you can do if you've got to get your wine out at a certain time. And now that wine has become big business, corporations need a release in February and March and April of the following the vintage often. Now, if you're a natural winemaker, and there are plenty in the world, and there's some fabulous wine in the world, but if you're going to work that way, what are you going to do if your wine just is not going to stop fermenting for 2 years?
I'm wondering about taste. I mean, you're saying there's all this stuff that's being added to wine. Our wine is much more adulterated than most of us assume. Mm-hmm. How come? I mean, I get the part that maybe it makes it easier to transport. Maybe it makes all the wine be ready to be put in the bottle at the same time. But surely it's also just about taste, about what people want in their wine.
Right. It's economically driven and market driven. And historically, wine sometimes have always been a little bit market driven. The British always like their champagne a little bit sweeter. And so a lot of people made wine in Champagne to their taste. So this has always been going on, but never quite to this entire level where there are marketing agencies determining what people want and then making a wine according to that.
What do people want in wine then?
Well, it's very interesting what people want. When a lot of response I've gotten to my book are people saying, you know, thank you so much. I thought there was something the matter with me because I didn't like the wine I was supposed to like. Everybody's and the world is made up of so many different tastes, and this is one of the problems with this one world, one taste. We don't all have one taste, and there needs to be room for delicate wines, not just blockbusters.
Mm. But could you describe the one world, the one taste that's
one
being
taste.
Marketed right now?
Kind of the mainstream taste that's marketed as mainstream. Okay, so it's going to be somewhat thick. a big, substantial mouthful of a wine with some vanilla and cherry aroma and flavor, which comes from wood or wood chips. And it will be, you know, just kind of substantial and chewy and oaky. That is mainstream wine today.
That sounds nice.
If it's a red wine. It's actually, the cherry vanilla stuff doesn't sound like wine to me. It sounds like some sort of confection or cake. So to me, it doesn't.
And sounds like Kool-Aid.
Yeah. Kool-Aid with a, you know, that's been put through the reverse osmosis to concentrate it. Yeah.
And what's a natural wine taste like by comparison?
Well, a natural wine can certainly be full-bodied. It depends on where it comes from and depends on the weather and it depends on the soil. And it does depend on how it's made and what kind of extraction. But basically, a natural wine will reflect the place, the land, the weather, the winemaker.
When you visit these winemakers and, you know, say, go out and walk their vineyards with them, can you tell just from walking the land that they're doing something different, that their wine is a more natural wine?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm just laughing because all you need to do is, I had last year I was doing a story in Champagne, and Champagne is pretty devastated by a lot of chemical use. And I was driving down the road in IE, and I pulled over to the side of the road because I saw a gorgeous vineyard in the middle of all this other devastation. And I ran out, and I saw it was one of my favorite winemakers. So you can really tell at least the attention that they give to the soil. And I do believe when it comes to your grape, you are what you eat. The dirt absolutely does matter. If you're using chemical to interfere with that process, you're interfering with the way the grape interprets the soil. A lot of people believe, as I do, that making a wine with its own yeast, the yeast that it comes with on the skin and perhaps in the winery, that holds the DNA to that year. And that is why one wine from this year won't taste like the one from the next. And that's part of the excitement and the mystery of wine. So I can't possibly categorize how a natural wine tastes in any other way except that it tastes alive.
Alice Fiering talked about natural wine with Anne Strainchamps. Her book is The Battle for Wine and Love, or How I Saved the World from Parkerization. To the rest of the country, 1976 was America's bicentennial. But in California, that's the year everything changed.
Wine is sunlight held together by water. The poetic wisdom of the Italian physicist, philosopher, and stargazer Galileo Galilei.
The words of Galileo are brought to life by Alan Rickman in the film Bottle Shock, which premiered at the 2008 Sundance Festival. The film was written and produced by the husband and wife team of Randall Miller and Jody Savin. The film tells the story of the Judgment of Paris, a blind taste testing organized by an English wine expert, the Alan Rickman character. To everyone's amazement, the wine from California wins. Randall Miller, who also directed the film, told me what the California wine industry was like in the early days.
It was really a bunch of farmers, a bunch of dirt roads, a bunch of people from other walks of life who had put it all on the line to, like, sort of get their dream of trying to make great wine in the spirit of the French great wine.
There's a character, Gustavo, that's a whole different tradition, and you get the feeling that there has been a little contention in Napa Valley between the upstarts who are coming in with the money and the folks who've been building good wines for a long time.
you know, Gustavo is a real character. I mean, he's a fabulous winemaker. He has a vineyard right now called Gustavo Thrace, and they've actually had a lot more interest in that vineyard since the movie came out. He is a hero in a lot of ways to the Hispanic peoples who, at the time when he rose up and started his own vineyard, most of the Hispanic people in the region were the field workers.
So what did he think? The tea bag, the Brit. Do you like your wine?
I'd like for you to try it.
Nope. You're on your own now, kid.
Are you firing me?
I can't afford you anyway.
You people. You think you can just buy your way into this? Take a few lessons. Grow some grapes. Make some good wine. You cannot do it that way.
All right, all right.
You have to have it in your blood. You have to grow up with the soil underneath your nails and the smell of the grape in the air that you breathe. The cultivation of the vine is an art form. The refinement of its juice is a religion that requires pain and desire and sacrifice.
Amen.
My father knew that. He was a field hand, and he never had the opportunity to make his own wine. I know that. And I'm gonna make it happen one way or another.
And he was one of the very first to go off to enology school and become a vintner himself.
I mean, he came with his family. I mean, his brothers and sisters and his father even worked in wineries and worked in fields. And he ended up going to UC Davis, which at the time and still is today is sort of the Ivy League school of winemaking,
yeah.
You know. So he was quite a, you know, quite a thing for him. And then for years he worked for Gergich Hills, and then he went over and started his own winery. So he's really quite a testament to that time.
The scene shift to Paris is pretty startling in the movie, and this is when word starts to get around. Was there really a Stephen Spurrier?
Yeah, there really was. Stephen Spurrier, played by Alan Rickman in the movie, was a guy who had a little bit of an inheritance. He went to Paris. He's a Brit. And he had this dream to open a wine shop and to have sort of a wine academy. And he had this idea, and he was making a go, and it wasn't that easy for him. He had great taste. You know, he had great taste in wine, but still, he was a Brit living in Paris, which we can sort of imagine how difficult that might be. And he had this idea that he would put on this, it was our bicentennial year, he would put on this blind taste testing and go and select California wines and bring them back. And thinking full well that most likely the French wines would, of course, triumph. And much to surprise, the opposite happened. And it was this event that basically was small, but it turned everything around.
How did he sell it to the French? I mean, you can't even imagine the French being willing to. They must have assumed that they were just going to mop the floor with these upstart California winemakers.
Yeah, I think they were thinking, screw cap wine. This is just going to be in and out, you know.
And, you know, he convinced these guys who he knew some of them. He convinced them, you know, there was a few people had to be paid a little bit of money to come. And he had this taste testing. And he couldn't get any publicity. He tried really hard to get, you know, the newspapers and different people to come. He found this one guy who later became famous for writing the book about this subject, George Tabor, who was a stringer for Time magazine. He'd never had his name in print in Time, but he'd written stories for Time.
Blind tasting, huh?
Yep. Sends out a message of impartiality. I don't think Terry and the other judges need to see a label to tell the difference between a Mouton Rothschild and a California twist-top red.
I don't know. If the French lose, they might bring back the guillotine.
Every great entrepreneurial inspiration has its risks.
What about publicity, huh? Hey, I know this guy, George. He's a great writer. He was even published in Time magazine.
The well-known wine journal. It's too American, too up itself. We need to involve the real news outlets.
You mean the French outlets?
Maurice, this is a sophisticated story. It will lend itself to sophisticated publications that appeal to a sophisticated readership.
I'll call George.
Even get a credit on the story he wrote about this event.
Yeah, in the actual Time magazine. It was on page 68 or something. It was a relatively small article. And 2 weeks later, after that article hit in the summer of 76, all the California wines sold out of New York, LA, and Chicago, and that's what started everything.
It's from California?
Mm-hmm. Chateau Montelena.
It won?
It won. Excuse me. May we have a bottle of the 73 Montelena Chardonnay, please?
No, sir, we do not carry it, but you are the eighth person to ask for it within the hour.
Hey, I'd like to buy a bottle of the 73
Montelena Chardonnay.
Yes.
Why is everyone asking for the same wine?
I would step back a minute, because one of the funniest bits in your movie is worth talking about. Spurrier did go to California, and he treated the wine business there as though he were in Provence, I guess, or in any part of France. He treated it seriously. But the Californians, I guess they'd never been treated that way before.
Well, he insisted that he would pay for taste testings.
What do you want?
To taste your Chardonnay.
No.
Did I mention that the tasting was blind?
Really? Because the world, or anybody who's at all conscious about what we're trying to do here, tends to think of us as a bunch of hicks taking on the French.
Sure enough.
You know, I don't know about you, but one thing we've learned around here is that if one person succeeds, we all succeed, so I won't speak for them. They might want to be involved, so I'll make some calls.
That's very magnanimous of you. How much do I owe you?
It really did change things, didn't it? I mean, this wasn't the end of it. There was a rematch, wasn't there?
There have been a number of rematches. And, you know, what's great is that it really was the moment that opened up the whole world. You know, it was sort of the democratization of wine in a way. And, you know, Australia and Chile and all the places that make great wine, it was the moment that really sort of opened it all up.
We have shattered the myth of the invincible French vine. And not just in California. We've opened the eyes of the world.
And you know what I say? I say amen to that, brother.
You mark my words. We'll be drinking wines from South America, Australia, New Zealand, Africa, India, China. This is not the end, Maurice. This is just the beginning. Welcome to the future.
One of the nice things about making a film like this, I imagine, is that you got to shoot all of those gorgeous, gorgeous pictures of vineyards and sunlight. Did the growers let you do pretty much whatever you wanted?
Yeah, I mean, they were very welcoming in the Napa Valley.
It was actually during the harvest season, because when you make a movie about wine, we all sort of think of, you know, grapes on the vine, and that really only happens a couple of months of the year. So it was their busiest season. So the fact that they opened themselves up to us was pretty outstanding, I think, for them.
Sounds like you had a terrific time making this movie.
It was really phenomenal. I mean, you know, the locations alone were so spectacular. That Chateau Montelena itself is just really a spectacular location, and the weather was great, and it's not too bad of a place to spend a summer. We spent all last summer there, and it's really
nice. We left Pasadena the day after school ended, packed up a U-Haul, put the two kids and the dog in it.
Yeah. Went up there and sort of forged it, hired a bunch
of
people up there.
We rented a little farmhouse out in the fields, and it was just beautiful, you know, those milky sunsets at night over the vineyards.
Hard
really
life,
nice.
This filmmaking business.
It is. And we had to drink some really good wine, which was just
Just for research purposes.
Just for research purposes, of course. Yeah.
Of course. Dirty Savin and Randall Miller collaborated on the independent film Bottle Shock.
I got a nickel, have you got a dime? Let's get together and get a little wine. Some buys a fifth, some buys a quart. But when you buy sherry, now you're doing things smart. Drinking wine's prettier to drink wine. Papa. Drinking wine's prettier to drink wine. Papa. Wine's prettier to drink wine. Papa. Pass that bottle to me.
Bottle Shock has a website. Come to ours, and we'll link you there. And while you're visiting, you can get more information about the music and the books featured in our show. The address is www.ttbook.org. We always like to hear from you. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Nickels and dimes. Time's getting tough. I ain't got enough to buy a little bottle of wine. Bottle of wine, fruit of vine.
When that's singer-songwriter Tom Paxton with one of the classics from his Best Of collection. We've been talking so far this hour about drinking for pleasure. But people also drink for a lot of other reasons. And it's terrifying how soon a pattern of alcohol abuse can develop. Corin Zailkas chronicles her teen years in a memoir called Smashed, Story of a Drunken Girlhood. Steve Paulson asked her about it.
Do you remember your first drink?
Vividly. I was at my best friend's house after school. We were in eighth grade. Her parents were out for the afternoon, and we were rooting around in her kitchen cabinets looking for something to eat, and she pulled out a bottle of Southern Comfort, and I took my first drink right then.
And what did you think of it?
It wasn't particularly delicious, not at all. And I didn't even get drunk the first time, but already just the act of drinking gave me this renewed confidence.
And that's interesting because you described then some of the first parties you went to where there was alcohol, mm-hmm. and it sounds like you felt like a different kind of person. In fact, I think you described yourself as when you were drinking, you felt exotic and dangerous, a cobra inside a kitty cat.
Yeah, I did. And I think I certainly went into drinking, seeking an effect, not thinking I was going to drink for the taste. There was this Bacardi campaign I really loved in the 90s when I was growing up. It was this buttoned up by day, Bacardi by night campaign. And during the day, they showed these meek little women. They were librarians. They were bookkeepers. And by night, they were wild when they were drinking Bacardi. So I don't know. I was always pretty shy and introverted. And I thought, oh, that's the secret. I just need to get my hands on a bottle and preferably the one with a little bat on it.
So did you really feel different? Once as you were drinking, did it feel like your personality changed?
Yes. As I got drunker, of course it did. I found that liquid courage, definitely. It was far easier to slur sweet nothings into a boy's ear when I couldn't talk to him when I was sober, couldn't summon the saliva to do it. And yeah, I think I also found pretty early on that it was an easy way to bond with friends. I expected to. It's much easier to tell my girlfriends how much they meant to me when we were drinking, that kind of Budweiser, I love you, man, kind of vibe.
Now, is this unusual for 14-year-olds? You're talking about there were parties of 14-year-olds where there was a lot of alcohol flowing. Is that common?
Yeah. Half of all eighth graders have tried alcohol. There was a study by the American Medical Association last fall that told us just how easy it is for kids to find alcohol. And actually, the study found girls have an easier time at it than boys even. We're always nicking liquor from our parents' liquor cabinets, whatever we could get away with. Someone always had a college-age brother who had no problem coming home and buying us a keg. We found the privacy we needed to drink anywhere because teenagers can't find privacy mm-hmm. anywhere. So it wasn't uncommon to hike 3 miles into the woods and have a party.
Now, you describe some rather harrowing experiences. I guess when you were 16, you ended up in the emergency room having your stomach pumped out, full of, vodka and Kahlua and rum?
Yep. It was scary. That was my first real close call. And I was still an inexperienced drinker at that time in the sense that I was kind of stupid. I didn't realize that it took a while for the alcohol you were drinking to take hold and affect you. So I was drinking more and more and wondering where that buzz was. Why didn't I didn't feel that little buzz yet? And then everything after that was a blackout. So, yeah, that was my first horror, and it scared the bejesus out of me, and it scared the bejesus out of my parents. But unfortunately, I wasn't scared straight. I mean, I was for a while. But I think the idea that I could be alienated, excluded from my friends who were still out drinking every weekend, scared me far more than any consequence that could come from drinking too much.
How did your parents react to that?
My mom cried. My dad was silent but very disappointed. My mom said anything could have happened to you. The doctor said if you had a few more drinks, you could have died. But I told them it wasn't going to happen again, and I meant it when I said it, too. I told them I wasn't going to drink anymore, and I didn't for a while, but it didn't last.
Now, it's worth pointing out that by your account, you had loving parents, you had a good home. I mean, there was no obvious reason why you would develop this drinking problem.
Yeah, my parents were present when I was growing up. They felt omnipresent sometimes. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. I was a ridiculously middle-class, middle-of-the-road American girl. And I don't know, I think it just goes to show it can happen to anyone in this day and age. And it is. Girls are drinking younger. They're drinking much more. There's no way to spot the bad kids. The good kids are the ones who are drinking, too. They're not failing out of school, which I think a lot of parents are told is an obvious warning sign. But I was always doing well and making good grades. And I think there's a real work hard, party hard mentality whereby as long as you're balanced, as long as you're working and studying just as hard as you're drinking, there's no real problem there.
Did your drinking change once you got to college?
Yeah, my enthusiasm for it was renewed because suddenly not only was there greater access to alcohol, but just the administration, teachers, parents, the world at large seemed to be saying, it's okay now. It's part of your college experience. Live it up before you have to have a real job and real responsibilities. It was a real shock to go into, as a freshman, a Friday morning class that was particularly quiet and have a teacher say, well, it looks like you all started your weekend early. I can smell the vodka coming off of you. And it was just really lighthearted and ha-ha.
You know, what's interesting as you describe this is, I mean, clearly looking back on all of these experiences, you had a drinking problem. Mm-hmm. And yet it sounds like you were pretty successful in a lot of ways. I mean, good student. It didn't really get in the way of moving on to the next stage of your life.
Right. It didn't get away of my academics. I remember I transferred into the journalism program at Syracuse because I didn't get in out of high school. And I remember I took the test, hungover, maybe still drunk from the night before, and I passed. And I got in to the very prestigious media school. So I did have that work hard, party hard mentality. But I really feel it affected so many other portions of my life. When I quit drinking, I felt really immature, really emotionally stunted because I didn't have the social skills that I needed that an average 20-something person ought to have.
So your social life was all built around drinking?
Yes, absolutely. Every friendship I had was based on the fact that you like to drink and I like to drink, so we ought to hang out. There was no real, nothing else underlying my friendships. There was no common interests. I wasn't making friends based on the fact that we liked the same kind of books or movies or bands even. Everything was centered around drinking.
But you say you did stop.
I did stop. I was 23 when I quit. And I wish I could have found the perspective I needed to quit while I was still a college student. But I think in part now I can see I felt really safe on my college campus. And we want students to feel really safe on their college campuses. But that was an obstacle in terms of recognizing that something was wrong with the way I was drinking. It was a very different experience to be 23 and living in New York and waking up from a blackout and not remembering everything that had happened the night before while I was around adults instead of students, in a strange city instead of a college campus, a dorm that I recognized around people I knew or kind of knew. I woke up one morning in New York after a night of drinking with my roommate, martinis at a bar downtown because that seemed to be very urban. And yeah, we woke up in this beautiful apartment, expensive, like nothing I'd ever seen before. But we didn't know who owned it and we didn't know where in the city it was.
You didn't know how you got there?
I remembered how I got there when I sat down and thought about it, but I kept thinking, if these guys could have been serial killers. If something had happened to one of us, I wouldn't have had a address to give a 911 operator. It was terrifying.
So just that day, you decided, that's it? I'm never going to have another drink?
That was the beginning of the end. And once I sat down and really thought about the reasons why I was drinking, because I had those knee-jerk reactions, the social constructions the industry teaches us, I thought I'd drink to celebrate and relax. And when I sat down and realized I'm drinking because I never learned how to bond with my friends, express interest in men, I never found an identity for myself outside of being a girl who's fun to go out and get drunk with. So I thought, I knew that something was wrong. I knew I would never be in the place I needed to be if I kept drinking in lieu of learning those things.
Do you consider yourself an alcoholic?
I don't consider myself an alcoholic, which some people have taken issue with, but I didn't write it because it didn't feel true to me. Because I've talked to a lot of addiction counselors who say that alcoholism is made up of two things. Abuse plus addiction equals alcoholism. And I certainly had that abuse down. I was binge drinking. I was drinking explicitly to get drunk. But I don't know that I felt or I feel that addiction the way I still feel an addiction to cigarettes, which have been so much harder to shake. So yeah, I think I was a binge drinker. I was an alcohol abuser, which is not to say that alcohol wasn't a problem for me, because clearly it was.
Corin Zailke spoke with Steve Paulson. Her book is called Smashed, Story of a Drunken Girlhood. And now, something that might have made all the difference.
She was young, she was pure, she was new, she was nice. She was fair, she was sweet, 17. He was old, he was violent, no stranger to vice. He was base, he was bad, he was mean. He had slyly inveigled her up to his flat to view his collection of stamps. And he said, as he hastened to put out the cat, the wine, his cigar, and the lamps, "Absom Madeira, my dear, you really have nothing to fear. I'm not trying to tempt you, that wouldn't be right. You shouldn't drink spirits at this time of night. Absom Madeira, my dear, it's a very much nicer than beer. I don't care for sherry, one cannot drink stout, and port is a wine I can well do without. It's simply a case of shackle and arse on gout. Absom Madeira, my dear." Unaware of the wiles of the snake in the grass, of the fate of the maiden who topes, she lowered her standards by raising her glass, her courage, her eyes, and his hopes. She sipped it, she drank it, she drained it, she did. He quietly refilled it again. And he said, as he secretly carved one more notch on the butt of his gold-handled cane, "Absom Madeira, mi dia. I've got a small cask of it here. And once it's been opened, you know it won't keep. Do finish it up. It will help you to sleep. Absom Madeira, mi dia. It's a really an excellent year. Now, if it were gin, you'd be wrong to say yes. The evil gin does would be hard to assess. Besides, it's inclined to affect me prowess. Absom Madeira, mi dia. There flashed through her mind what her mother had said with her antepenultimate breath. "Oh, my child, should you look on the wine when 'tis red, be prepared for a fate worse than death." She let go her glass with a shrill little cry. Crash, tinkle, it fell to the floor. When he asked what in heaven, she made no reply, up her mind and a dash for the door. "Absom Madeira, mi dia," rang out down the hall, loud and clear, a tremulous cry that was filled with despair as she bore to take breath in the cool midnight air. "Absom Madeira, mi dia," the words seemed to ring in her ear. Until the next morning, she woke up in bed with a smile on her lips and an ache in her head, and a beard in her ear all that tickled and said, "Absom Madeira, mi dia."
Michael Flanders and Donald Swann with Madeira, Madeira, recorded in 1957. It comes from the complete Flanders and Swann, available on CD. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. There's a reason why the words hard drinking and newspaper man go together so well. Neil Steinberg thought his life was practically perfect. He was happily married to a smart, sassy lawyer. They had two young sons whom they adored. Neil was a popular columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times and had the routine of commuting to his house in the suburbs down pat. Until one day, it all blew up in his face. He tells the story in a book called Drunkard, A Hard-Drinking Life. Oddly enough, Steinberg says he never realized just how much booze he was going through in an average day.
I didn't really measure it. You know, they say it's a disease of denial, and you try not to pay attention to it. I don't know, on an average day, I'd have a few drinks at lunch. I might pop out in the afternoon. I'd catch something on the way to the train. I'd catch something on the train. I mean, there was no average day. I wasn't one of those guys who was under a trestle drinking a quart of alcohol every day. I had a job. I had kids. I wrote books. I wrote things. It's sort of something I did on the sly between one place and another.
The way you write about it makes it sound as though you really enjoyed.
Oh, I loved it. I mean, it was a passion of mine. And I've had people tell me they read it's the first recovery memoir that makes you want to drink. And I think because I wrote it while it was going on. You know, this was something that was a sensual pleasure. You know, there are lots of people who enjoy wine and enjoy booze, and I was one of them. And it sort of just crept up on me. I mean, part of the book is I'm going through my life trying to figure out, when did this become an obligation? When did this become and I really can't figure it out. It went from something I did to something I liked to do to something I loved to do to something I had to do.
You know, it's funny. Your business, too, sort of is connected to this. There's a whole history of hard-drinking newspapermen. I don't know. Was drinking part of being a successful big city columnist?
Oh, sure. It was the pot of booze at the end of the rainbow. You got through a day. You did something horrible. You stood in the morgue watching people's heads be cut open and their brains weighed, and then you went and had a bunch of drinks afterwards to decompress from it. Now, it definitely was. And on election night, you go to the Goat, and there'd be 200 people there, and Mike Royko in the corner having his vodka tonics, and it was just this one happy, lubricated sort of thing. And where I was densest was I really didn't quite figure out that the party had ended.
Well, in the crisis in the book, and we got to talk about it sooner or later.
Of course.
It has to have been hard for you to talk about this. There was a really bad night.
Yeah, and I wrote it awful. I mean, some people read that scene and they hate the book and they hate me and they don't care about anything else.
Well, what happened?
And, you know, I came home from a long day of drinking, and I get in bed, and I've made it through the day, and my wife basically throws me out of bed, and we have this altercation, and I slap her. And I go to jail. And so the book starts with me in jail. And the odd thing is that there are people in Chicago, I've been writing for 25 years for the Sun-Times, who hate me for something I wrote about the Pope 10 years ago or something. So in their minds, I'm a wife beater now. Okay. And the odd thing, it never happened before, it never happened since, which sounds like I'm minimizing it again. And I'm not. I'm just saying it's a tale about drinking, that this incident was the unacceptable thing which pushed me into rehab.
Well, in fact, you'd written earlier, hadn't you, that if you ever tried to hit her, you'd draw back a bloody stump.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the downsides of it. And my wife's a lawyer, and she's this fiercely independent, fiercely determined, you know, proud person, and it was horrible for her to be portrayed in the media as a battered woman. On the other hand, it was something that, as I said, I'm certainly not proud of it. But on the other hand, when I wrote the book, you know, she read it and she had a chance to have input into it. And the one thing she did do is she made the fight even worse than it was, because, you know, she was the sober one at the time, so she had a more clear account of it. People talk about the book as being brutally honest, and I don't really view it like that. I open it with that quote, you know, why not say what happened? And that's my attitude towards it. As a writer, I've always felt that if you're not trying to look good, then you can do some really interesting things and you can write some things. So I've never been somebody who's trying to puff himself up.
Well, let's just follow the story through for a little bit, because the essence of it is that you hit your wife. She called the police.
Right.
And you were thrown in jail.
I was thrown in jail, spent the night in jail, and then the next day I'm out in court, and the judge says, well, you can go to rehab in the Cook County Jail, and they have a fine one, or you can go to rehab on your own outside. And I thought about that for a second, and I took the rehab outside. And I think that's one of the things I'm most proud about with the book, is that I like to write about obscure things. In one of my books, I have a chapter on the National Spelling Bee. And so this is a book that says what happens in rehab. We always hear about rehab. Lindsay Lohan is in rehab. But we don't know what rehab is. And so I try to show that. And to me, rehab was awful. It wasn't this soft, gauzy thing that people make fun of. It was the autopsy of someone you love. because this was something I really liked and planned to do every day for the rest of my life. And this was teaching me why that was bad, why I was deluded, and why I couldn't do it anymore.
And this was 28 days, which doesn't sound like very long, but for somebody going without a drink for the first time,
it's an eternity. You know, I wasn't going to work. I certainly wasn't you know, doing my own routines. The thing which I'm proud of is that I decide, you know, some people, they drink during rehab, and there were plenty of people thrown out during the program because they showed up to rehab drunk. And I said, well, look, I have to do this. And I'm always an opportunist writer, opportunist kind of writer. I find myself in a situation, I think, oh, let's write about this. And so the reason I wrote the book was I thought, when I found myself in rehab, I thought, well, let's try this. Let's always hear about this. Let's go into it sincerely and see what it does.
So no drinking, no nothing at all.
Yeah, the first few months, yeah, I didn't drink at all because I viewed it, and that was really the big epiphany in the book. I viewed it as something that my wife was imposing on me. You know, I have a wife, I got two young kids. The choice seemed to be move to the Red Roof Inn, continue to drink, or stay home and try to be sober. And as much of a lush as I was and am, I didn't really want to be that guy and move to the Red Roof Inn and see my kids on every other Tuesday. And so I could stand on the billy goat and drink myself to death. That didn't seem the path of the champion.
On the other hand, it isn't an absolute yes or no, because you had arguments with her about whether there would be, for instance, that bottle of cognac that...
Oh, yeah, the bottle of Scapa, yeah, 1960 Scapa. I had this bottle that I bought 15 years ago of single malt scotch from the year I was born, and her initial, you know, immediate reaction was, we're going to sell this on eBay. And for some very strange reason, I wanted to keep that. And to this day, I have a hard time understanding either it represents some sort of futile hope that I'm going to go back to what I consider normal one fine day, or it's some sort of symbol. I mean, it's, you know, I haven't opened the thing for 20 years, so it's not like I'm really looking forward to savoring it.
But you still have
it. It's still in the basement.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because as you say, there is no scientific program for ending the drinking life. But AA seems to work.
AA does. I mean, I compare it in the book to Churchill's line about democracy, that it's the worst system available except for all the others. And that's kind of AA. It's the least. I mean, think about it. Here's this supposedly genetic biological brain disorder. People are fairly clear about that. And how do you cure it? Well, you gather together and you have you rely upon God and you rely upon the company of your AA friends. And those are the two things I was most armored against. I never believed in God for a second in my life. And I'm probably the most antisocial person I know. I remember being a child and people would come to my front door to want to play kickball. And I'd turn to my mother. I'd say, Mom, the guys are here. I got to go out and play with them. But wait 20 minutes and call me back in. You know, because I wanted to be – that inn was where I wanted to be. And so, I mean, part of the book is I'm going through this and I'm thinking, you know, here I am. I've decided to put my all to it. I'm trying my best. And I'm in this basement with these guys, you know, who are not exactly the people I picked to be. I mean, I'm a unhumble, superior feeling kind of person. And it was a blow to my ego to go through this, but one that I went through and I think helped me. Because what AA tries to teach you is that, you know, let's put your will on hold for a minute. Your will is what got you here. And why don't you try to either to listen to other people, to put your faith in something bigger than yourself? I mean, there's a lot of good things that it does.
I can see this, and especially the talking with other people. I mean, it doesn't sound as though it ought to work, but it's a very powerful tool. What I'm curious about, and I never did get from reading the book exactly how you dealt with it, is the essence of AA is this higher power thing. You're Jewish, but it doesn't sound as though accepting a higher power is easy or even possible for you. But somehow...
This is the metaphor I came up with. Let's say you're in a car accident and you're burned. And the helicopter, the medevac, shows up from Loyola University Medical Center here in Maywood, which is this fabulous burn unit. And they're going to fly you off to be treated there. You don't prop yourself up on one charred elbow and start to complain about your problems with the Pope, right? You just go and you do it. And you forget the fact that it's a Catholic hospital. And that's kind of like AA. They have all this God stuff. To me, it's unfortunate because it never factored into my sobriety. I kept waiting for God to show up and help me, and he just didn't. And I wasn't believing in the proper way. People said, but whatever it was, he never became it. The ineffable universe power never came and helped me. But here are these people who are getting together in church basements and talking about alcoholism and their problems. And where else do you do that? You can go to a hospital and pay someone to do that. You can hire a therapist, which I also did, which helped. I mean, you want to talk about this. When you're forced to give up drinking and it's something you love and you don't want to give it up, I had this bottomless need to babble about it to people. And I would go from one person to the other and sort of try to discuss this because you're in this box and I'm a smart guy and I'm trying to figure out how to get out of the box.
And these are the people who understand. I mean, there's hardly anybody in AA who doesn't like drinking, is there?
And they've been there and they've found something to replace. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. People who haven't read the book think I'm criticizing the program. And it's really a church. And hundreds of millions of people, if not billions of people, have had their lives enriched by church and they embrace Jesus and it makes them do good things. I'm not one of those guys. And so in a sense, I had a tougher road because I had to find reasons not to drink that didn't involve the ultimate power of the universe giving me a big wink and a thumbs up.
It's nice to have the drunkard in the past, isn't it?
I'm hoping it is. I mean, you can't be too confidence is bad in this. I mean, if I came in and said, yep, fix that, problem done, never drinking again. I mean, you see people like that in the program and they end up or oftentimes or sometimes fail because then your guard gets dropped down and you go from this isn't a problem anymore to it's not a problem anymore, I can drink again. I was concerned about my kids. You know, I have two boys, Ross and Kent, 12 and 11, and they're in the book. And I ran into my brother-in-law at a party. This is early when I was writing. He said, oh, what's your new book about? And I said, oh, it's a recovery memoir. And he looked at me, and he's kind of a tart individual. He said, oh, your boys will be so proud. And I thought, yeah. As a matter of fact, I think, I think they may be proud because they're going to see what I went through. And this is a nightmarish ordeal for people. I mean, one thing I'm glad about the book is it sort of explained to my wife what was going on because she, like many relatives or loved ones of alcoholics, figured I drank because I'm a jerk. Okay. And that might have been an element, especially early on. But at some point, you stop drinking because you're a jerk and you drink because you have to because it's this horrific compulsion that's ruining your life. That's why the booze is so alluring in the book is because it is alluring to you. You love it. You adore it. It's your focus and your heart and your passion. And it's this huge part of your life. It seems like you're getting rid of yourself. Okay, you're not pulling yourself away from booze. You're removing your soul along with booze and throwing it out. And you're becoming this shell sleepwalking, this surviving shell. I think that's where the spirituality is so appealing to so many people is because it gives them something to remember. I mean, people go to AA twice a day sometimes. And there's nothing wrong with that. I read a lot and I write and I work and I raise tomatoes.
Neil Steinberg writes for the Chicago Sun-Times. His memoir is Drunkard. A hard drinking life.
Rye whiskey, rye whiskey, rye whiskey, I cry. If I don't get rye whiskey, I surely will die.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's www.ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1019B, Drinking Pleasure. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, and Carmen Jackson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.